Well, today we finish up our summer series on the book of Daniel by taking one more look at the story we read last week, the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Now, if you listened to last week's teaching, you may recall that I talked about how this story is often used to make a point, which is something along the lines of this: God is mighty to save us. And my comment was that while there's obviously, no denying that that was very much true of Daniel's experience, we need to be a little bit careful of how far we press that point in our own lives. Daniel's experience isn't always the way things turn out. You only need to look at, many of our Christian forefathers, people like the early Anabaptists, who were themselves exposed to great danger because of their faithfulness to God, and most of them didn't get rescued. Many of them perished for their faith when they were exposed to that kind of danger. In fact, if you really wanted to make a direct comparison to the story of Daniel, while Daniel survived the lions, there are other accounts of early Christians who were likewise thrown to the lions, but in those cases, the lions did end their lives. So yes, God always can save. That doesn't mean he always does save in our immediate experience of life. I also said that if we meant that statement in the sense of an eternal perspective, that when all is said and done, we can count on salvation, that God's victory on our behalf is assured in that eternal sense, then from that perspective, it's very appropriate to say that this story serves as a reminder that God is mighty to save us. And that is the angle I want to explore today. So we're going to read the story of Daniel and the lion's den once again from chapter 6. And I want to encourage you as we do that to be thinking about the story in terms of that perspective I just mentioned. This time through, instead of thinking about the story from sort of a historical and kind of immediate context, I want you to consider as I read how this story can serve as a metaphor, as a sort of like pattern or precursor for the ultimate salvation that God promises. So here's the story again. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself amongst the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever. The royal administrators and prefects and satraps, advisors and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being for the next 30 days, except to you, Your Majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, Your Majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the window opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about the royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except you, Your Majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. Then they said to the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed and determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. And then the men went as a group to King Darius and said, Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. So the king gave the order. And they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, May your God, who you serve continually, rescue you. A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God who you serve continually been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered, May the king live forever. My God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty. The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted out of the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. You know, I find it to be very interesting the way in which, if you really consider the plot line of this story, it very much follows the pattern of one of our very well-known New Testament stories. So let me give you a summary of Daniel 6, and as I run through this summary, see if you can start to hear that other New Testament story kind of layered on top of it. So here's Daniel 6. The story begins with a group of powerful people who feel their position and authority is being threatened by Daniel. And so they conspire against him. Now, unfortunately for them, they can find no real basis by which to discredit him. So they devise a plan to put Daniel in peril through a manipulation of the higher authority in the land, the king, and do so in part by setting up the king as the only legitimate authority, and thereby making Daniel's allegiance to God a way by which to entrap him. These conspirators set their plan fully in motion when they find Daniel in his customary place of prayer. The higher authority in the story, the king, doesn't want to carry out the sentence against Daniel. And in fact, he labors to find some way to free him. But he's reminded by the conspirators that his hands are tied. So Daniel is thrown into a den of lions. A stone is placed across the entrance, and it is secured with the king's seal. Daniel must rely on God to deliver him from this danger. Extraordinarily and unexpectedly, very early the next morning, Daniel is discovered to very much be alive. Now, as you listen to that, does that sound familiar? Does that sound like a New Testament story you've heard before? See, like Daniel, Jesus was the target of a conspiracy by a group of powerful people, the chief priests and the elders, whose position was threatened by Jesus. They too looked for some sort of testimony against Jesus in order to condemn him, but they couldn't find anything. So they devise a plan based on trumped up charges and false witnesses, and they seek to manipulate the higher authorities, Pilate and Herod, into condemning Jesus. Their manipulation of Pilate includes this declaration saying, "We have no king but Caesar," affirming Caesar is the highest authority and thereby setting up Jesus' allegiance to his father as a way to entrap him. The conspirators' plan is fully set in motion when they discover Jesus praying in Gethsemane. The higher authorities, Herod and Pilate, find no fault in Jesus. And Pilate, in particular, works to try to free him. But in the end, Pilate feels like he's been backed into a corner that he can't get out of, and so eventually allows Jesus to be condemned. After the cross, Jesus is placed in a tomb. A stone is rolled across the entrance of the tomb, and it is secured with a seal. Jesus must rely on God to deliver him. And indeed, very early at sunrise, Jesus, like Daniel, is discovered to be alive after all. See, in so many ways, the story of Daniel is a foreshadowing of the story of Jesus. The number of similarities are quite uncanny, if you ask me. Of course, there are a few differences which set apart the story of Jesus as superior, as even more amazing than the story of Daniel. Whereas Daniel faced the possibility of death, Jesus actually did die. Whereas Daniel emerges from the lion's den without a scratch, Jesus emerges from the tomb with the physical marks of his crucifixion. Whereas Daniel emerged from the den only to die again at a later date, Jesus rose from his grave, never to die again. The story of Daniel in the lion's den is a dramatic and amazing story, but it is only a precursor of the most dramatic version of that story ever to be told, which is the story of Jesus. But we shouldn't stop just there in looking for a pattern, because as the story of Jesus follows the pattern of the story of Daniel, so our story, the story of you and I who follow Jesus, follows the pattern of Jesus' story in at least one very dramatic and important way. And to find that pattern, we turn to the Apostle Paul, who writes this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. "But Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive. But each in turn, Christ, the first fruits, then when he comes, those who belong to him. Then the end will come when he hands over the kingdom to God the Father after he has destroyed all dominion, authority, and power. For he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy to be destroyed is death." Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. This picture of first fruits is an important picture. A first fruit is the first part of the harvest. It's that first apple taken off the tree. It's that first cluster of grapes plucked from the vine. And by definition, a first fruit means that there will be more to follow, specifically more of like kind to follow. If the first fruit you pick off a tree is an apple, you expect that in a few weeks' time, it will be full of more apples, not full of bananas. A first fruit points out a pattern to follow. When we look at Jesus' resurrection from the grave, we're certainly intended to see in that act his victory over death. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But if we stop there, we miss part of the fundamental meaning of calling his resurrection a first fruit. See, by using that specific term, Paul is saying that when we look at the resurrection of Jesus, we see the pattern for our own resurrection. We are raised like Christ was raised. And what was the nature of Jesus' resurrection? Well, amongst other things, I think one really noteworthy detail is that Jesus' resurrection was material. It was a bodily resurrection. It was not just spiritual in nature. Jesus didn't rise just with his sort of spiritual essence and no material body. In fact, you know, implicit in the word resurrection, as it's used in the Bible, is that it has to be bodily if you can even call it a resurrection. And any sort of afterlife that does not include the physical aspect, by definition, is not resurrection. I think it's noteworthy that even in Jesus' interactions with his disciples after he emerges from the tomb, he's going out of his way to prove to them that he's not just back as some spirit, but he's very much physically embodied again. He says to the unbelieving disciples, "Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have." The resurrected Jesus has flesh and bones. And he's offering that fact as prime evidence that he has indeed been resurrected. And then when his disciples are still struggling to believe it's him actually back from the dead and not just a figment of their imagination, he eats a piece of fish while they're watching, again, specifically to just prove to them that it's him physically alive in their midst. Now, you might think that all this talk about the nature of resurrection is, you know, much ado about nothing. I mean, the afterlife will be what it'll be, so why make a fuss about it? Maybe it makes for interesting trivia, but does it have any bearing on what we believe? And I say it absolutely makes a difference. Because I think that what you believe about the nature of Jesus' resurrection has a direct impact on what story you think the Bible is telling. So let me try and unpack it this way. There's a way some people read the story of the Bible that turns it into a sort of great escape story. And it goes something like this. Once upon a time, there was a powerful creator who made a creation that he said was very good. Unfortunately, in time, that creation was defaced, marred by human rebellion. So the creator abandoned his original plan for that creation and instead sent Jesus to lead a rescue party so that when people die, their spirits can escape the planet and be whisked off to heaven before God eventually tosses all his material creation onto the cosmic scrap heap. I got to be honest with you. It's not a story I find very compelling. Actually, that's an understatement. I find that story to be problematic. Because you see, if you ask me, in that story, God comes across either as A, someone who throws in the towel at the first sign of trouble, or B, someone who simply isn't powerful enough to set things right again when they've gone wrong. I mean, if human sin is really that powerful that God is forced to scrap his plans and settle for something less than what he originally intended his creation to be, what kind of God is that? It's not the one that I find in the pages of Scripture. Now, thankfully, I don't feel the need to make sense of that story because I don't believe that's the story the Bible aims to tell. No, the Bible actually tells a much better story. The story of the Bible is not of a God who gives up on his creation project. It's not a story where Jesus is little more than a rescue boat meant to save us from a sinking ship. No, the story of the Bible is the story of a God who's determined to see his creation project reach its intended end. It's the story of a God who refuses to let sin and death alter his plan for this world he's made. It's the story of a God who promises that one day he will set everything right again, and he's big enough and powerful enough to make good on that promise. And exhibit A for believing all of that is the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus, who comes back from the dead, not just as half of who he was before his death, as though God only cared to redeem his spirit, but as one who has been made alive again, both spiritually and physically, materially, which signals to us that God's redemption plan for all of his creation is likewise to renew, restore, and redeem all of it, the material and the spiritual. God is all-powerful and sovereign and is unwilling to abandon one square inch of what he's made, unwilling to let human rebellion derail what he set out to do from the very beginning. Folks, the cross is not an escape plan. The cross is an overwhelming victory. Redemption is not God giving up ground, but God retaking ground, reclaiming all that is rightfully his. The Bible points us to a day where there will be a new creation, creation set right, creation finally having become what it was always destined to one day be. The plan that God started when he made the universe back in Genesis 1 is the plan that God sees through to completion in the book of Revelation. See, death is the unmaking of God's creation, but resurrection will be its remaking. And what a day that will be. And thanks be to God, we already have been given a sneak peek of what that's going to look like as we gaze upon the already resurrected Jesus. And so today, in a special way, we want to again gaze upon this Jesus in a way that we do each month as a church family, by participating in the Lord's table. It's at this table that we remind ourselves that Jesus, by his death and resurrection, has not just made a way for creation to escape the clutches of sin and death. No, more than that, he has defeated sin and death. He has made those things powerless by overwhelmingly being victorious over them at the cross. I suspect that it's probably not very often that the words of a pagan king are used to prepare the hearts of people for participating in the Lord's table. But as we wrap up this series on Daniel, today having bridged the story of Daniel to the story of Jesus, it felt to me like the declaration of King Darius at the end of chapter 6 was appropriate to come back to in this moment. And so I invite you to hear again these words of praise that were on the king's lips, with a little addition from the Apostle Paul tacked on to the end for good measure. The Lord is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. Just as he has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions, through Jesus, he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. May you experience the presence of God profoundly in these next moments.